I have decided to love. If you are seeking the highest good, I think you can find it through love. And the beautiful thing is that we are moving wrong when we do not do it, because John was right, God is love. He who hates does not know God, but he who has love.
She who hates does not know God, but she who has love has the key that unlocks the door to the meaning of ultimate reality.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. My name is Gail Leftwich, and I am director of Cambridge Forum. The theme for discussion is Beloved Community, Visions for a World Beyond Racism. We will open our conversation with the observations of two quite notable thinkers and writers, Professors Bell Hooks and Cornel West. Ms. Hooks, currently Distinguished Professor of English at City College in New York, has become a renowned teacher, author, and speaker on the issues of personal empowerment and the politics of race, gender, and class. A prolific author, her most recent book is a memoir, Bone Black: Memories of Girlhood. Cornel West serves as professor of Afro-American Studies and Philosophy of Religion at Harvard University, and is a widely recognized lecturer with a much-loved, mesmerizing speaking style. He, too, is a prolific writer, well-known particularly recently for his best-selling book, Race Matters, as well as numerous other books and essays. Our panelists for the program are Dr. Willard Johnson, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he specializes in teaching and researching topics relating to African studies, with an emphasis on international relations, development policies, and institutions. Writer and essayist Rebecca Ferry, who currently teaches in the expository writing program at Harvard, and who has written about and is especially interested in the intersection of race and gender in American cultural history. Carolyn Toll Oppenheim, who has been a newspaper and magazine journalist specializing in issues of ethnicity, urban affairs, and intergroup relations for more than 25 years, and Preston N. Williams, Houghton Professor of Theology and Social Change at Harvard Divinity School, and a widely recognized Martin Luther King scholar and past president of the Society for Christian Ethics. And finally, our moderator is Florence Ladd, director of the Mary Ingram Bunting Institute at Radcliffe College. She is also the author of the recently released, extremely well-received novel, Sarah's Psalm. Welcome to Cambridge Forum, Florence Ladd.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And I welcome this wonderful audience. We want to begin with Bell Hooks and Cornel West, who will engage us in a searching examination of nation, community, culture, equity, justice, freedom. Bell Hooks, Cornel West.
Thank you very much.
I mean, partially Cornel and I are going to address some of the difficulties of where we begin with beloved community. I haven't seen Cornel for a while, and the first thing I said to him today was, I still love you, because for the first time since I have known Cornel, I feel significant political differences with him as I go around. And it's been interesting to me because it was very difficult for me, because he has been such a comrade and is such a comrade, to disagree with him and to be public about saying, I don't agree with something he said. And I think that that goes to the heart of how we often conceptualize community wrongly and beloved community wrongly, which is that we do not have a space for disagreement, and that disagreement means somehow the end of love, and not that it's the beginning of a fuller, deeper, richer love.
Mm, Very much so. Very much so. Would you like me to read this quote that you
asked? We were going to start reading a quote from Martin Luther King.
Yeah, we think this is an appropriate starting place, other than saying that we're glad to be here. It's always a joyous occasion for me to be here with my comrade and colleague and sister, Bell Hooks, I must say. I was talking about how much I love Bell Hooks. And I'd like to thank Brother Thomas Michelson for his visionary leadership of this institution to bring us for bringing us together. But we thought it would be crucial to begin with this quote from Brother Martin Luther King Jr. This is from his speech, "Where Do We Go From Here?" Martin says, "I have decided to love." Major decision. If you are seeking the highest good, I think you can find it through love. And the beautiful thing is that we are moving wrong when we do not do it, because John was right, God is love. He who hates, and this is Martin saying he who hates does not know God, but he who has love has the key that unlocks the door to the meaning of ultimate reality. That's from Martin.
I have decided to love. If you are seeking the highest good, I think you can find it through love. And the beautiful thing is that we're moving wrong when we don't do it, because John was right, God is love. She who hates does not know God, but she who has love has the key that unlocks the door to the meaning of ultimate reality.
And for me, love is not a soupy, syrupy kind of thing. And I think this is crucial, because in a market culture like our own, in a hotel civilization like America, love is either reduced to some kind of stimulatory lust or some kind of sentimental passion. What love is about, struggle. What Sister Bell was talking about when she acknowledged the degree to which we have various kinds of disagreements, she was saying, Cornell, or Brother Cornell, we need to escalate the level of our struggle together. And one of the reasons why it's so difficult to talk about love in America is because we live in such a sentimental and melodramatic culture. Which is to say, we like to stimulate feelings without any serious action or commitment. And of course, you cannot talk about love without talking about death. And of course, America's been denying death ever since she began as a city on the hill. Cities on the hill don't die. They're eternal, they're above history, they last forever. But love is fundamentally about death, because it's about profound desire, facing certain limits, but struggling nevertheless. And of course, we cannot invoke Martin's talk about love without acknowledging the degree to which he loved us so much that he was willing to die for us, each and every one of us. Now, I'm not suggesting that martyrdom is normative for serious struggle, but it's always lurking in the background for those who are serious about love. We talk about our love. I talk about loving my wife, Elaney, and so forth. I'm willing to take a bullet for her. That's serious. I love my mother. I'm willing to take a bullet for her. That's serious. Now, whether I'm willing to take a bullet for each one of you all is another question. But I'm in process.
And this is one of the spaces where we don't always agree. I'm much more interested in the symbolic willingness to die to things of the past symbolically and be born again. That is to say, I think that when we talk about love in connection to racism and white supremacy, essentially we're asking that all of us in this nation be willing to die to values, attitudes, beliefs that many of us have held on for years, and be born again in another way of thinking about the world. When we talk about white supremacy, I mean, I've been on tour the last few days, and what I've encountered among most of the white people who have interviewed me is a resistance, one, to acknowledging racism as existing at all now. And the other, a real resistance to the use of the term white supremacy. And then a kind of conflict, because people are surprised that I then go on to talk about love, because they expect me to remain in the place of anger or anger at injustice, which I think there's probably not a person in this room who isn't committed to freedom that doesn't have a certain amount of rage at injustice when we begin to feel helpless and powerless about our capacity to do anything about it. And I feel that we as a nation have begun to feel very helpless and powerless about our capacity to do anything about injustice, particularly racial injustice.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very true. I think that's just a wonderful move that you made. Yeah, a wonderful move that you made in terms of the death of certain ways of looking and the death of certain ways of life.
And I think we are at a time in our culture and civilization where we'd rather avoid love and life and kind of muddle through with a market existence, which results in actually avoiding any encounter and confrontation with these legacies. And one of the roles of prophetic churches and mosques and synagogues, one of the roles of secular progressives, is to continually remind us that we are not going to make it as a society if we think we can just muddle through, and that this is serious business. Much is at stake. So it's not just chit-chat and talk. It's about struggle. But struggle means sacrifice, service, cut against the grain. It's about what goes hand in hand with love, which for me is one of the most precious virtues of being human, which is courage. And love and courage go hand in hand. I think there is a waning of courage in the mainstream and maelstrom. On the prophetic margins, we still see it in relation to race and gender. But there's a waning of courage. Most people are arguing these days by the lives they live that courage is not worth it. Let's just conform and accommodate. Let's just go with the flow.
If you want to change the structure of something or intervene on it, you have to be willing to have that little moment of chaos. You cannot have the smooth running system. And I think one of our resistances to change is we want the smooth running system, whether we're talking about our personal lives and love, the community of our domestic households, and yet we're smart enough as a nation to know you don't get a smooth running system in your personal household that you really have to process. The reason I bring that up is often we respond negatively to the moment of process. Mm-hmm. You know, even myself, you know, one of the things when I said to Cornell is, you know, I don't agree with some of the things you're saying lately. But I didn't really want to greet him after not seeing him for such a while with having to admit that I don't agree. Now think about that. We're two people who forge so much in dialogue, and I can still feel afraid to say to him, I don't agree with you. And I think that so much of our shying away from anti-racist struggle is the fear that we have that when we come together in our differences and there is disagreement, we will have conflict and everything will fall apart. So many people feel it's better not to come together. It's better to stay with people that are just like yourself, where you can feel safe, where the smooth running can happen without any moment of chaos or conflict. But in the true spirit of both spiritual and political revolution, in the best sense, we cannot begin to build beloved community without embracing the moments of tension and conflict as part of the struggle, as part of what we're seeking. We're not seeking an end to pain, a way out of death. The other day I had the joy of interviewing a wonderful Buddhist teacher, and I told her I'd been meditating on this passage in her book, Pema Chodron, that she quotes where the Buddhist teacher says, don't even think for a moment that you're not gonna die. And I said, you know, wow, it's like when I try to think about that every day, it shakes up my day to have to really think that what I do today, if I think that I'm gonna die when I wake up in the morning, and like all people who fly, I sometimes have panic. Yeah, yeah. And I think—
For good reason.
I think I'm not gonna make it. And I notice that when I wake up and I have that feeling that I may not make it, it completely alters the spirit of how I live my day. Suddenly, I can do the things that I really feel are truly vital and important for that moment. You know, I can choose my struggles more wisely. All of those things happen, so I think that that willingness to see pain and death as part of the struggle, as part of the embrace for justice, is part of what we have to return to. Because as Cornell was saying, I think that people fear sacrifice. When people hear that you have to sacrifice, that makes the whole thing undesirable. But no one wants to sacrifice.
No, that's true. And there's so many different forms of sacrificing, from unpopularity to marginalization to backstabbing being talked about. And sometimes, in an ironic way, folk who think they're not sacrificing actually are. It just haunts them later on. But for me, I think, and I think about our dialogue, especially around the Million Man March, there's another crucial feature, let's say, of our dialogue, and that's trust. Love, courage, and trust. We used to talk about it in terms of solidarity in the 60s and 70s, but it's really about trust, and you're able to trust friends, comrades, partners, companions, and so forth, while engaged in intense disagreement oftentimes, because you're not in any way ascribing malicious intent. And that's one of the reasons why when Sister Bell told me, she said, you know, I've got some deep disagreements with you about the Million Man March. And I said, well, you know, there's some good, wonderful, and lovely people on both sides of that question who I agree with on other deeper levels. But you don't give up the struggle over the disagreement. I still think I have a good argument. And I know Belle believes she has a good argument, and we wrestle because we're not trying to anyway avoid that conflict. See, this is not any kind of sentimental reunion or communion in this regard. That's why, in a way, even the title, the subtitle, Beyond Racism, I'm a little skeptical of that formulation. I think we had to go through racism. We got to go through it. You see, because we'll never get beyond it if we think somehow we can just jump over it, sidestep it. You got to work through it. And by working through it, I mean not just working through it with battles and affirmative action in California, not just working through it by being against Mark Furman and the Ku Klux Klan, right? Or not just working through it with some kind of exemplary homophobe or anti-Semite and so forth, but it's beginning with yourself. Because it's shot through one's own heart, soul, and mind. It's in your dreams. I don't know what they are, but I know they have to be shot with some kind of xenophobia if you're in this country. I know mine are. I'm not going to go into detail. And I wrestle with it.
I wanted to ask you a question, though, Cornell, because as you were speaking and you were saying, I'm sure I have a good argument and I'm sure Belle has a good argument. What I thought was, I have a better argument. And when you really hear my argument, you will have the conversion experience. So, what I thought about, because I think this is, I mean, basically, when we go to a person who is racist or who is addicted to white supremacy, And when I say that, I don't mean a white person, because there are plenty of people of color who are addicted to white supremacist thinking. And that tends to be why I prefer it as a term rather than racism, because it allows all of us to start where we are. Every person in this room, where do you stand in relationship to white supremacy? Because you could be married to someone black and still think black people are genetically inferior. You could be black and married to someone white, but still feel that they have no rhythm and can't dance and can't love. You know, all of those forms of white supremacist thinking that all of us hold in our lives. So what I was thinking about is I feel that I have to own that when it comes to racism and sexism, I want people to have a conversion experience. I don't want to just hear their side. I don't want to hear them explain to me how homophobia is natural. Not, you know, it's natural, it's God's will or what have you. So I wanted to ask you, some about what you feel is the point of openness, because I was also trying to think about what is the openness to change? Where do we open? Earlier I was saying to Cornell, I don't even know if you agree with what I'm saying in the last chapter of Killing Rage, because I was saying two things in this book. One, that I felt progressive feminist thinkers, women, were much more hopeful about our capacity to end attachment to white supremacy and racism in the dailiness of our lives. Two, I was saying that in our lives, there are those of us individuals in this room who really live our lives in beloved community, in relationships with people who are diverse and different, who we feel are fundamentally anti-racist in who they are. I'm interested in us theorizing from that. So, I mean, could you talk a little bit about if you are, Cornell said he had been thinking about this. I want to hear from him if he feels open to explaining what leads to that moment of openness and conversion where you're willing to think maybe something I stood up on national TV and said for weeks and weeks, I might not believe anymore. I have to go through that a lot. I've been saying something for the past few weeks that I just found out had a flaw in it, so I have to go back to those situations and clear up what I said.
Yes, I've been wrestling with that last chapter, especially the claim that certain black male intellectuals tend to have less hope, tend to be a bit more downbeat, tend to talk much more about darkness and thunder than light and sunshine. And I think that's certainly the case in my own work. There's no doubt about that. I think the older I get, the longer I live, the more deeply entrenched I see the white supremacy and male supremacy, which is another way of talking about the more deeply entrenched I see various forms of evil in our day.
Well,
I was never a cheap optimist, but there was once a time when I was a bit more upbeat. And when I see black sisters, especially black womanist intellectuals, they tend to be much more upbeat. And I think it's gendered. The situation of black men in America is despicable, sometimes beyond description. I go to the prisons. I see what's going on. I can look around the streets. And then I link that to the larger issue of how in the world are we going to preserve and expand non-market values like love and trust in this market culture that's being gangsterized every day from on top, not from the bottom, from the top, from White House, from State House, from City Hall, educational systems. Will there be any space for this hope that we've talked about? Now, I am a prisoner of hope to the degree to which I'm going to go down swinging. It's true. But I want to know what Goliath actually is like, fundamentally understand the nature of Goliath so I can get my slingshot in better shape with little David. And so in that sense, there is a gendered character, I think, to at least our struggles together in this regard. And I think your observation is a powerful one.
Well, we're about to close our part, but I wanted to say that perhaps it's a gendered thing that I would choose as my metaphor, not David and Goliath, but actually Jacob wrestling with the angel, because there is no loser in that struggle. There is no sense that there is a sense that there is a struggle we can wage that is fundamentally a struggle, and we have to wrestle with it, and we have to fight. But the outcome is that there is no loser. Because there is no loser if we can establish beloved community. There is no defeat for anyone. I think that is part of the destructive thinking of white supremacy, that if we have justice for everyone, someone loses. This is a struggle where everyone comes out further illuminated. That R&B song that we should be blasting in this church right now, "Your Love Has Lifted Me Higher." Because indeed, if we create beloved community, It means that we have all learned to love in a way that lifts us higher.
I would want to draw a distinction between penultimate losers and ultimate winners. Because when you look at global capitalist forces, from Wall Street to London to Tokyo, they will consider it a loss if white supremacy were eliminated, if poverty were eliminated, if working people were empowered. One of the reasons why they're so euphoric right now, because they know those wages are still gonna go down and those profits are still gonna go up, you see. But they're penultimate losers. And I affirm what Bella's talking about. In the end, they disinvest from white supremacy, disinvest from male supremacy, and allow some more egalitarian distribution of wealth. In the end, they'll be winners, because if they keep going in the present course, it's all gonna come tumbling down anyway, you see. So we're a winner, yes, as Curtis would say, in the long run. But penultimate losers, there's gonna be some penultimate losers. Because at this very moment, there are some penultimate losers in chocolate cities. Those who are paying the cost of the present social arrangement. Working people across the board, whatever color, are penultimate losers. But the winning in the end, based on these non-market values, I think, of love and courage and trust and so forth, is at least still a possibility. I've still got hope.
And our dialogue has to continue because that language was so disturbing. Penultimate losers.
Nearly half a century ago, the world was riveted by the book Cry, the Beloved Country. And I remind you that the subject, the beloved country, was South Africa. The issue, apartheid in South Africa. The theme here, beloved community. The issue, is it not apartheid in our communities? We have four panelists, and we are going to try to continue this discussion. And then we will invite you to the microphone, and we want to hear your cries for community, your cries of sorrow, your cries of hope, your cries of joy, your cries of suffering. Who will follow?
I'm going to say a few things about Martin Luther King and the background of these terms. We know that the term beloved community is a theological concept, a philosophical concept. It comes out of Josiah Rice, and it's part of the understanding of the kingdom of God, and Martin Luther King, of course, spoke about it in terms of a beloved community. It's a vision of a world of love and harmony and peace. And as a Christian theologian, we know that that sort of world never comes in its completeness on earth. It is a vision which motivates us and causes us to constantly strive for the enhancement and the enlargement of justice and equality. Now, King also affirmed that the way that one proceeded towards that goal was through love. And love always included conflict. Love always excluded sentimentality. Love was a creative goodwill, which was the manifestation of the love of God in the human individual, and kept the human individual working on behalf of justice. This was a vision which animated Christians and non-Christians, according to King, because he saw the universe as structured according to the understanding of justice. The arc of the universe is long, and it's been in the direction of justice, is a phrase he liked to constantly intone. Now, the notion of white supremacy I come to from reading Cornel West's Prophesy Deliverance. It, of course, has been in our literature for a whole host of years, but he conceptualized it in that book in the way I think that we want to understand it today. And what he is suggesting there is that most of the institutions in our society have been constructed in a way that favors the upper classes in the society and favors white members of the society. And these things need to be corrected. And anyone who looks at the history of the laws and the Congress and the business institutions and so forth in the United States, I think can find ample documentation for that skewing of the structures in which we live our lives. And so when we talk about white supremacy, it seems to me that fundamentally what we are saying is that the structures and the institutions in which we live our lives must be corrected. Now, when we talk about personal characteristics and so forth, we have to remember also that these are structures and institutions. What we talk about as our culture and the inner nature of ourselves is not something which is created wholly from within. It is something which is a result of our interaction in a larger world. And as a consequence, even the inner attitudes become distorted because of the nature of the society in which we live, and we must straighten those things out. And as been pointed out, this applies to all of us, black and white alike, because we are members of this particular society, and these structures and institutions that we're talking about have formed and shaped us. Now, there's much more that I want to say, but I'll just stop there.
I'm Rebecca Ferry. I want to appreciate some of the things that Cornell and Bell have said. As a person who has been reading their work for a long time, their work together, their work separately, I especially appreciate the way they exemplify the courage which love enables to confront barriers of difference in our culture. And it's differences of race, differences of gender, differences of sexuality, differences of class, that those are arenas that all of us have to face as we struggle to achieve a more equitable community. I like the idea that Bell offers us that there are no losers if we achieve beloved community, and Cornell's reminder that all of us stand to lose, some of us more than others, if we fail to achieve that community. I also want to say that I think it's important for us not to be afraid to use the term white supremacy. As a student of American cultural history, I know that that was an ideology that began to be constructed in the very earliest moments of conquest of this continent and creation of this culture. And until we confront that long history and all the ways in which we have been positioned within it and complicitous with it and struggling against it, it will continue to hold its power over all of us.
Let me jump in next. I'm Willard Johnson. I must say that I don't think we can make it in a world of Davids and Goliaths. The unequalness that that image conveys to us, I think, is at the heart of the matter here. One had best have a slingshot and more if you are, in fact, in the presence of the Goliaths. It might be well for us to admit that intentionality could be an important dimension of this, and David might want to do right. I mean, Goliath might want to do right. He might really want to do right. But it's awfully hard to expect people who are so used to dominating and to monopolizing and having their way without opposition to change on the basis of mere intentionality. Maybe a warning can be given, an invitation to change their status and their stature. But in the end, I think what David needs is a helpmate with another slingshot. And so that brings me, I really think back to the issue of the empowerment part of it. We invoked a little while ago the imagery of the apartheid. A lot of you in this room were part of the struggle against apartheid. One of the things that I guess justifies my being at this August table is a role I played in that. And reflecting back on that often, I sense what it was that was so importantly different about the way in which that struggle went forward. And one of them was the emergence of some powerful black leadership in a position to lead the coalition in a way that couldn't be denied. And now it behooves us to understand that as we go from that experience to any other, to look for ways in which we are able to build a coalition, a powerful coalition, not one that has to be based on trust of the other person changing, but is in a position to really command that there be new ground and new relationships and a new understanding. And if Goliath cannot make that transition, then Goliath must fall. But the really key question for us is, you know, the Davids and the Candaces and the Bells and the Rebeccas and the Carolyns and so forth, who will join that struggle as well? Hopefully, also with some slingshots when we need it. And so, to me, that really is part of my appreciation, anyway, of the wonderful, not irony, but double entendre in Cornell's book, Race Matters. It is about the matter of race. And as we try to overcome race, there's a recognition that it really does matter, that it is of consequence. So this struggle really does pit antagonistic intentions. And what makes it of commanding importance is the disbalance, the imbalance of power between a David and a Goliath. And I don't think we'll get anywhere building an approach and a program around the what can only be a hope and a not very well justified one from the reading of human history, that Goliath will change.
I've watched Cornell and Michael Lerner have dialogues before this, and now I have the treat of watching the two of you have this dialogue. And part of building beloved community is creating these kinds of dialogues. But I think it's something more than that, and it's something I got from your chapter, Bell, in Killing Rage, when you said that people who are of an older generation, who grew up prior to the civil rights movement, and that is my generation, have memories of a time when people had more hope about building beloved community. And I'm realizing that I have images in my memory that my children don't have, that my students don't have, of a time when people really believed that we could make a just society in America. Naively or not, because people believed it, they were able to form hopeful relationships together. Now, part of that time was there were some experiments, there were some utopian experiments, and one of the things we have in American history is utopian communities that attempt to do what this gentleman spoke about, create the ideal way of living that can never be achieved. You know, we've had a lot of utopian communities that lasted for 50 years and died. And I think we need to start building some tiny utopian communities that give a living image for people of what we're trying to achieve. In other words, we can't change the whole society at once. The reason that I found South Africa so exciting is when I met some people at a conference here who were talking about the building of that society after the election and the practical work that they're doing of weaving together the vision from the African National Congress, the vision of the bringing in people who are already in leadership positions in society, trying to find some way of living and working together. That's the practical daily work of building a community. And we need to build some communities here where people do that on a daily basis that can have visibility. I don't know of any here now. There were experiments with multiracial suburbs. Morris Milgram built a whole bunch of them in the 50s around Philadelphia. There are stories about how they failed, they didn't survive. I think we need to dedicate ourselves to trying again in various places, and then using that as a base to go out and proselytize this vision and make these safe spaces for ongoing dialogue on the problems of doing that.
In this sanctuary, we have brought together activists and theologians. And among you are also activists and theologians. I come to a moment like this wanting a group, a congregation, if you will, like this, to move the dialogue forward. And I think some of the answers, some of the examples, some of the challenges that will change our communities and change the heart of this country are among those of you who are moving toward the front lines and are moving with love, with trust, with anger, with frustration, moving us toward the next stage in the struggle for a just and equitable society. It's your turn now.
Yes, I'm David Bickham, and I'm from Mississippi. And sometimes I get so distressed by the intellectuality of these conversations from intellectuals, in that I don't know if people understand that suffering exists and that people exact suffering upon one another. In the context of dialogues, there are historical advantages, economic advantages, educational advantages, material advantages. And I don't particularly get excited about dialogues because as we dialogue, some of us are at the same time we talk about capitalism, we're full beneficiaries of it. And beyond that, it's often based on race. So what I'm saying is, I have no problems dialoguing with my wealthy white sister, my wealthy white brother, or my literate white sister, my literate white brother. But I'm no fool to think that the discussion about beloved community in some kind of way abnegates itself to what's going on in the real community.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that question, brother. Definitely appreciate that question. Indeed. I think we have to talk about the way in which particular economic systems generate wealthy people and the ways in which those wealthy people are parasitic on working people, many of whom are relatively impoverished. And so part of this is a question of just truth-telling. But there are certain sacrifices in telling that truth in our society. And when you connect it with legacies of white supremacy, it's even more so. The question is, there's going to be a number of different contexts in which dialogue takes place. Cambridge is one context, Roxbury is another, Harlem's another, South Side of Chicago is another, Wall Street is another. I think dialogues ought to take place across the board when they're a form of struggle. But see, dialogue is not a substitute for struggle, it is a version of it. Chit-chat is not struggle, see. Dialogue, you're actually trying to convince persons that they ought to take risk so that when they leave dialogue, they're different than when they enter. And for me, that's very important because the only way you can organize and mobilize people is to try to convince them to take a risk. And if you can't convince them to take a risk, there'll never be any significant organizing or mobilizing among oppressed folk, you see. And so in that sense, I think dialogue is very important, even as we're self-critical and honest with ourselves. So.
I spend a lot of time among poor people in general. I spent a lot of time in Atlanta, Georgia the other day, and what I'm here to tell you is that the suffering that many people are experiencing is not solely material deprivation. Mm-hmm. And that part of the issue is we are kidding ourselves if we think any form of wealth alleviates suffering. And it does seem to me that one of the big illusions poor people have had is that money will mean an end to your suffering. And when we talk about beloved community, this weekend I was together with a very poor black man, my brother, me with my in-between upper class money, and we were together with a very wealthy white individual who inherited wealth when she was 5 years old, never has had a job, et cetera, et cetera. And she was experiencing a lot of suffering. And my brother just couldn't believe it, because he has believed all his life that if you just have enough money, you will not have certain forms of pain. And unless I think we alleviate among ourselves the notion that material well-being, which is a positive virtue, it's what we long for and seek, all of us. But I think that part of the suffering many of us are seeing in our lives and in poor communities is just that suffering that comes from believing that wealth will mean you won't feel any more pain. Even though if we were listening to the testimony of so many wealthy people, one of the reasons I was saying to the white woman, you could give up some of this wealth because obviously it's not making you happy. You know, you could share it with some people. You could open it up. You could expand it, as she does. Which I think also, to me, when I see these people together, who in quote real life would rarely come together, these people whose lives are so radically different, this young black man who sees himself as an endangered species, and this dyed blonde, it's very important that she's dyed blonde, white woman with her wealth, who might never talk to each other, but who sit down at the table and talk together about the nature of suffering and about the degree to which wealth will not intervene on suffering and the nature to which we are all overwhelmed by this belief that poverty is the location of pain. Poverty in and of itself does not have to be the location of pain. For me, that's really important to acknowledge.
I really doubt that white supremacy and capitalism will change through a conversion experience, no matter how much I want to believe that or how compelling your arguments may be. So I really look forward to hearing more about that, and maybe that's your next book. But if there's something more you want to say about that today, that'd be great. But also, I think you're really right about hope, and I was wondering if you have anything to say about Paulo Freire and Pedagogy of Hope. And also, the third thing, you could take your pick, you know, but the third thing I'd be interested in hearing a little more about is your whole thing about overcoming the dualism of David and Goliath, of the weak and strong. That's so Buddhist, and part of your response could have been straight out of the work, you know, the mouth of the Dalai Lama. And yet, I think every activist has the experience of rage being important, and rage is extremely problematic in a Buddhist way of looking at things. It's not that you can't have it. You can have it and work with it internally, but you can't identify with it and have that be okay in a Buddhist way of looking at things. So personally, in my own activism, and I am a Buddhist, I find this hard to reconcile. So I guess I look forward to your next three books on these things.
I don't want to say very much to those questions, but I do want to say that I think that the writing of women, visionary women, has been different, because we have been writing out of the concrete experience of working with children in primary schools or other people who are, they see concrete manifestations of change. I wanted to be clear with people that I don't bring my messages of hope to you out of some fantasy, that it's out of the concrete reality of experience. And that's why I think the writing by these women is so strong and so powerful, because it's not coming out of a test tube. It's coming out of the concrete daily life struggles women have been having with each other, within organizations, to make a change. So that I think that if we have a choice? I always say to my students, if we got 10 white people up here, and 9 of them are refusing to divest of white supremacy, and 1 of them is willing to divest, why do we then say white people aren't willing to change? Why do we give the 9 people more power than the 1 person who has shown themselves willing to change. Why doesn't our hope lie with that one person and their capacity to influence and to intervene in solidarity with us? And it's against this, I again have to go back to a critique of patriarchy and capitalism. Because you see that when you choose the 9 over the 1, that's the basic principle of capitalism too, going on there. Quantity. Why is it that we don't want to focus on those models that offer us concrete methodology so that our hope is a lived hope, it's in lived experience, so that we continue to say it cannot change, it will not change, when in fact, I think that our capacity to transform lies in watching the activity of the one over the 9. And I think this goes back to Cornell's message of trust. We have to trust. We have to have the faith that is based on the non-visibility of the 9, that the one is the hope. The light that is shining is more powerful because it can expand and grow. And I think that to me is a question of a paradigm shift. And I feel that a lot of times we're not willing to make the paradigm shift, which is what keeps us stuck in the same old dialogue of hopelessness.
I am an immigrant. All my life I experience prejudice, bias, and you know what. So I do talk from my own experience. And I want to ask you, and I 100% agree with Professor West and Professor Hooks, how eloquently you explain everything. I agree. But why do you talk only about white racism? How about black racism? What you say, I saw you, Professor West, in Howard University with Rabbi Michael Lerner. You remember the reaction of black students? They insult him. They hate him, and even you couldn't help that. How about Khalid Mohammed from New York University? And you, Professor Hooks, have to know exactly what he preached. He doesn't even have nothing restrict him. He just say about he's a pure anti-Semite, and he say exactly what he wants to say. He doesn't use euphemism, and nobody mentioned here. You cannot have beloved society if you will just find out that one group is wrong, but another group is completely right.
That was for me, I think, though, right?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I appreciate the question. Hatred is a promiscuous phenomena. It will lie with anybody. No one ever denies that hatred is not cut across race, class, gender, sexual orientation. It is a human, all too human affair. Bernard Shaw used to say, hatred is the coward's revenge to those who intimidate them. And we all are subject to it. There's hatred in me. There's hatred in you all. Anybody free of hatred, stand up and exemplify your self-deception. That's not the point. See? The point is, when you talk about love, you're talking about struggle. That's why we began by talking both about love and struggle, but also talking about white supremacy, which can also lie with anybody. You recall Sister Bell's point was too many black folk have it, right? Black supremacy, of course, it is an option that persons can choose, right? There's no doubt. White folk can be black supremacists. Some actually are when it comes to certain spheres of life that we won't go into at the moment, you see? But the difference is the hatred, be it a hatred of a colleague, Muhammad, a hatred of anybody. But at the same time, when we were talking about beloved community and talking about America, black supremacy has never been the major obstacle standing in the way of American democracy. It's been a set of beliefs that a small number of folk have with no power at the institutional level whatsoever to generate consequences. So what do? We must recognize the moral level,
Hatred is hatred is hatred, no matter what. But at the institutional level, a nation grounded in white supremacy, right? Grounded in white supremacy. And if we're not willing to wrestle with that, then we want to be moralistic and not serious about struggle across the board.
So maybe we could close by both of us speaking to, I decide more and more every day to love. I'm obsessed with love precisely because I believe in its power to transform our lives. And I share that with you because I do think there is such a contempt for love in our culture. And that contempt is tied to our contempt of women and children. It's tied to all of those things. I feel that as we return love to its political place in revolutionary politics, we go back to a place of hope. I feel that hope in our bonding always, and I feel that hope for the larger world.
No, very much so. I think it's, let's get a hand. I think when we understand love in terms of this struggle motivated with by compassion and empathy and sympathy, it's really love or die. It's fundamentally love or die. And for me, the question has always been, given all the death in my life, existentially, politically, and so forth, I could only be who I am because somebody loved me. Somebody cared for me, thoroughly undeserved. And in that regard, one recognizes what Martin meant when he said love is, in part, this key that unlocks. He didn't say it explains it. He didn't say he had a metaphysical theory to understand the nature of it. It opens it up for possibility. And that love linked to justice, linked to freedom, linked to creativity, what else is there to be human at its best than that compassion and creativity and openness, experimentalness, improvisationalism, and so forth and so on. So I hope we don't leave with this abstract, disembodied conception of love, but understand it's concrete, it's tangible, it sustains, it soothes, it caresses, but it also unsettles. It also challenges in that regard. So you got critique on the one hand, but you also have connectedness on the other, you see. Well, another way of putting it is we got Socrates, unexamined life not worth living. You got Hebrew Bible, New Testament, the weeping, the wailing, transformed into struggle for mercy, justice, and love. And you got North Carolina with John Coltrane, who fuses the true together. An exercise of critical intelligence rooted in a deep love, but keeping his eye on a vicious evil in America called white supremacy, and knowing you can't keep your eye on that evil only if you're serious. You keep your eye on all those practices and ideologies that lose contact with the humanity of other people. And if we then can't follow through, maybe we deserve to die. And I don't think we do. We're going to struggle.
Thank you, Professors West, Hooks, and our wonderful moderator, Florence Ladd, and our panelists. And we are particularly grateful to the First Parish in Cambridge Unitarian Universalist and the Massachusetts Foundation for the Humanities, who helped sponsor this beloved community series. You've been listening to a program of Cambridge Forum, a free public forum in Harvard Square, Cambridge, Massachusetts, co-sponsored by the First Parish in Cambridge Unitarian Universalist, the Lowell Institute, and the Friends of Cambridge Forum. Thank you.